Okay.
This is Deanna Spingola. It is Saturday, May 25th, 2013, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Veronica Clark. Her websites are veraiconapublishers.wordpress.com and veronicaclark1.wordpress.com. Welcome.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. And you?
Doing well.
Is it as cold in California as it is in the Midwest, in the Chicago area? It is so cold today. So
it's dry. Actually pretty cool. It's been an unusually cool May here. Which, I mean, it's usually blazing in my area because I'm way on the outskirts.
Right.
And it's usually very hot, certainly by the end of May. So this is highly unusual. And I guess it's supposed to rain Tuesday. I'm like,
Yeah. That's
really strange.
Exactly. I grew up in California. I grew up in Sacramento.
Oh, okay. A little bit colder there.
Yeah, just a little bit. But gosh, by this time we'd have things coming up in the garden and it would be just very nice. This is terrible.
Right. I mean, I guess I'm kind of okay with some of this climate change, but, you know, I don't know what's caused. It's kind of a little bit nerve-wracking. It's like,
right.
Are we going to be okay? Because everything's strange. Our trees are losing their leaves when they shouldn't. Things aren't growing at the right time. It's just strange.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even the animals are losing their hair too late or too soon. It's just odd.
Right.
And I think the global warming is nonsense, but we're definitely experiencing climate change.
And it's definitely coming from, it's man-made.
Oh, yeah. Well, just the other day, in fact, all this last week, the chemtrails, what they call them,
mm-hmm.
all over the sky, every single day. I've pointed out to all my coworkers, see those in the sky? Those aren't clouds. They even acknowledge, they're going, okay, a contrail disappears. A chemtrail dissipates into this wispy cloud and makes the whole sky all milky.
Right. It's terrible. What they're doing is absolutely terrible. I've had a lot of guests on my program speaking about this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also the issue of the tornado in Moore, Oklahoma. And Duchesne just put up a video recently in the last two or three days talking about this. And he's got all the paperwork and all the evidence that demonstrates that the government has done this and
mm-hmm.
that it is against international law for them to practice weather warfare in other countries. They have to do it to our country. And so when they specify, when they are targeting an area, they don't say Oklahoma or they don't say the Midwest. They say, okay, let's do Moore, Oklahoma today.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very specific and very targeted for a particular area.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that tornado is obviously extremely large. Strange timing. We've really had nothing like that.
Right.
So, yeah, I definitely agree that there's some odd things going on.
Right. You have 24 little dead children
mm-hmm.
and people who've lost their homes, their cars, everything they own, and yet they are not aware of how or who did it to them.
Right. Yep. It's sad.
It is.
The ignorance and the obliviousness is sad, especially of Americans. We seem to be the most blinded of all.
Indeed.
Yeah. So, well, yeah. Okay, well, with that, I guess we can go ahead and jump into perception.
Exactly.
Fits right in there.
Indeed.
Getting back to our NLP. I just thought an interesting section of this book, Chapter 2, and this is, again, going back to Introducing NLP by Joseph O'Connor and John Seymour.
Okay.
It says, the world we perceive is not the real world, the territory. It is a map made by our neurology. And then it's further filtered through our individual and societal beliefs, interests, and preoccupations. So we really don't see the world as it really is. And this is kind of something that should strike people as a little bit profound.
Indeed.
Everything sees the world differently. An ant has a completely different perception of its existence in the earth, etc. And it's just important that people step back and acknowledge that mankind does not see everything, and we certainly don't see it as it really is. Therefore, when we hear a scientist say, 20 billion years ago, the Earth did this, this, and this, and we know about supernovas. And no, you don't. Right. We really don't know anything. So just important to keep in mind, we have like a microscopic snapshot of everything,
right,
given our perception.
And depending on our experience, our education, and even it talks about a woodcarver here and a painter that mm-hmm. are, for instance, in my quilting, uh-huh. I was very aware of different fabrics and different colors and different shades and variances of color and dimension. But mm-hmm. and it's according to a person's education and their experience. And not everybody right. has the same experiences.
Exactly. Yep. In fact, my niece has started quilting. I can't sew worth of anything. I can't even use a sewing machine. I barely made it through home ec.
Well, you poor little thing.
So there you go. But I can bake. Yeah, so exactly. Mankind itself sees very little. Our knowledge is but in a flea's brain kind of a thing.
Sure.
And we need to acknowledge that. And then on top of that, just each society, Americans, Germans, Iranians, we are also very limited in what we experience, what we know about the world. I can never be a German in Germany or an Iranian in Iran. I can never perceive the world as they do. And we need to, each of us, acknowledge that. We are so very limited. And the only way we can even remotely get an idea of someone else's perception of existence, reality, values, what's important, is to talk to them and try to be empathic. So just very important to ground ourselves, humble ourselves, and acknowledge that we know very little and we perceive very little.
And it's very, very interesting, too, in just what you said. In the American government or the American military, just being so, I don't know, hypocritical
arrogant
or exclusive
yeah.
or whatever, that they want to impose what we experience here, that they would want to impose a political agenda, a political kind of a system on them. Who are we to be doing anything to anybody, any other country?
Exactly. And I'm hoping that eventually human beings will get to a point where they see that war is really and truly average people being used by governments as battering rams against one another, when we're all just, the masses of every country are all just trying to work and live. All we really want is a job, some security, the benefits of our collective efforts in the realms of science, technology, sociology, psychology, etc., any fields. That's all anyone really wants. They have to propagandize you to get you to go be their battering ram. And it really is governments versus governments. But since governments don't want to die against each other, they use the people. We need to get away from this. And, you know, Germany is probably the most promising country. And I cannot help but think that their past has definitely created this context today. But they actually want their armed forces and are starting to train this way. The subordinate officers and even privates can refuse to implement an order, to carry out an order, if they feel that it is morally wrong or ethically wrong. They can actually tell their superior, I'm not doing that, and refuse and not get in trouble. That's where we all need to be.
Right. And that's actually the protocol for the U.S. government's military mm-hmm. throughout this country. But I don't think anybody actually realizes that.
Right.
And of course, we are all brought up on this very authoritarian kind of a situation where we are expected to follow our leaders.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, it's not. It is not obligatory mm-hmm. in the military.
Right. And I mean, even in the NS armed forces, there was a lot of defiance. And one simply just didn't tell the higher authorities what they were doing. They mm-hmm. acted on their own initiative and basically said, to hell with what Hitler thinks, or to hell with what Himmler thinks.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, those people came out on top because they were in the East. They were dealing with the reality of the political situation on the ground, whereas the authorities were too far removed from it and didn't really grasp what needed to be done there. Eventually, Himmler does. And there's a very good conversation between him and an individual in the SS named D'Alkuen. It's literally D-Alkuen. And it's in this book, The Illusion. I think I sent you the link to it.
Mm-hmm.
Soviet Soldiers in Hitler's Armed Forces.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the two sit down and D'Alkuen tells him, look, we're losing. You are wrong about your views of the Slavs. This needs to change. And if you don't change, it's all over. I can tell you right now. And he just laid it out to Himmler. And Himmler was like, oh, my God, you can't talk to me like that.
Right.
And you know what? He sat there and listened, and he took it to heart because he immediately changed the SS policies. The problem for them was it came too late. The change came, but it was much too late. It was already 1945.
Oh, way too
so
late.
So they needed to use General Vlasov much, much earlier. They should have cut him loose. They should have taken the chance with a potential revolt, little bit of mutiny. And in my view, I don't think that there would have been a huge mutiny. I think for the most part, Vlasov was honest, and his men were honest, and that they wanted to create a free, liberated Russia that would be an ally of Germany. And the two would create a new Europe together. And Vlasov was going to be the quote-unquote dictator of that new Russia. It's really a tragedy that it didn't happen. Hitler was just a little too stubborn. And Himmler was too small in his political thinking. So it didn't quite happen. But again, going back to our just thinking about perception, we need to be sympathetic and empathic and at least understand why the NSDAP had the views it did of Russia. It was all shaped really by 1919 and that whole Soviet threat in Germany. It shaped that whole generation of veterans.
Right.
And the whole NS party was basically rooted in that veteran cohort. So historians really need to stop judging and saying they were so stupid and how could they not see it and what fools. No, you weren't there. You didn't experience that. You need to understand that given that so many people did, and it dictated so much of their thinking about Russia and Vlasov, etc., that was very real to them. It was very serious to them. And you probably would have gone right along with it if you were back in that time.
Sure.
Mr. Historian. So, you know, we have to be careful not being too judgmental in history. And of course, just getting back to perception, we have representational systems in our brains that are also limited. When we think about what we see, hear, feel, we recreate these sights, sounds, and feelings inside of us. We can't actually go back literally in time and walk through that forest that we once walked through. You remember it in your head, and it all comes back to you. And different people have different representational systems that they prefer when they remember. Some people are visual. Some people are kinesthetic. They feel back in time. They'll get back in touch with the feelings they had.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are auditory. They'll hear the sounds of that memory. There's olfactory, you'll remember the smell. Maybe your grandma's amazing almond butter cookies or something like that. And then gustatory, gosh, I remember how good those tasted. And generally, we have all of these, but there's one that dominates in all of us. I am a visual.
I think probably 75% of the population are very visual.
Mm-hmm. And visual, auditory, and kinesthetic are the primary systems in Western cultures.
Right.
We're just taught that way.
Right.
So we do indeed sort of discriminate in the educational system against those that don't have those dominant systems. And they tend to struggle in school.
Right.
So when somebody says, I see what you're saying, they're not a dum-dum. They're a visual representational person.
Sure.
I see what you're saying. That means I understand what you're saying. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
Here's one of the examples they used. Some of the predicate usage that we might hear. Let's say a bunch of these different people that have different representational domination systems read a book. The first might point out that he saw a lot in it. The examples were well chosen to illustrate the subject, and it was written in a sparkling style.
Mm-hmm.
We can actually see that review, and it means something to the visual person. The second might object to the tone of the book. It had a shrill prose style. In fact, he cannot tune into the author's ideas at all, and he would like to tell him so. That's an auditory.
Mm-hmm.
The third feels the book dealt with a weighty subject in a balanced way. He liked the way the author touched on all the key topics, and he grasped the new ideas easily. He felt in sympathy with the author, clearly kinesthetic.
Right.
They all read the same book, and yet we have three completely different reviews. So the good author will try to touch on all of those in their book. They'll try to draw in every different kind of representational system so that every reader feels that, oh yeah, this book speaks to me.
Sure.
So sensory-based words, adjectives, adverbs, and verbs are called predicates in NLP literature. So anything where you say, I saw something, I felt something, etc., that's just a predicate. And then I guess with that, that's perception. I think we've pretty much covered that. We've covered the fact that we all have a lead system, visual, kinesthetic, auditory, that we prefer. So when you first remember something, it's going to be, oh yeah, the picture's in my head, and then maybe everything else will come with it.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe the feeling first, and then the picture comes later. So next we can go to, we pretty much covered memory. But I do want to touch on just one very interesting thing about memory in this book. Basically, we take information in from one sense and represent it internally with another. So sounds can conjure up like visual memories or abstract visual imagery. We talk of tone, color, and music, warm sounds, and loud colors. An immediate and unconscious link across the senses like this is called a synesthesia. And the synesthesia is, these form an important part of the way we think. And some are so pervasive and widespread that they seem to be wired into our brain at birth. For example, colors are linked to moods.
Oh, absolutely. That is so true.
Right. And interestingly, in a red environment, your blood pressure and pulse rate will increase.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of strange, but it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And synesthesias happen automatically. It's, you know, one can also make some. You can create them. But there's some that are just hardwired.
Right. It's kind of interesting. When I was teaching quilt classes, people would bring their own fabric, and then I would help them to design a quilt.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell just about how a person was emotionally just by the colors that they chose. And there was this one young student, she was probably, I don't know, 25 or something.
Uh-huh.
And she just had all of these dark, dark colors. Mm. And I just made the comment I said, you must be very depressed. And she said, well, I am taking something for it. And so you really can tell. By what people wear, the colors that they surround themselves with, what they gravitate to. It tells you so much about them emotionally and how happy or distressed they are.
Exactly. Yep. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they have a very interesting quote about translation. Now, this is an issue because I had one German guy contact me many years ago, and he said, you know, if you read Mein Kampf in German, the English translation is completely different than what is actually said in German, but that's okay. And the quote in this book is literally, just as a translation from one language to another preserves the meaning but totally changes the form, so experiences can be translated between internal senses. So we need to understand that when you translate material from one language to another, and especially from one era to another, it's going to be completely different in English versus German or Spanish or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
What you're really concerned with is conveying the meaning. And so this is why it's important to have several different translations of one text, because each translator is going to have a slightly different spin on the meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And even the author himself or herself may not have conveyed his or her meaning in his or her own words appropriately or accurately. So when somebody says something, it may not have been in the best terminology. And maybe they actually meant something kind of different, and it just came out in the wrong words. And then you have to consider editing. Who edited the material, cut it down, altered it slightly, etc., which also tweaks meaning.
Certainly.
So just important to keep that in mind.
And even, well, I'm sure that you've found that when you're writing something and perhaps you go back a couple of days later and you think, no, this doesn't read well. And so you redo it so that it is more precise and more exacting so that people will understand exactly what your meaning is.
Exactly. And it's not easy, especially when one has to self-edit.
Mm-hmm. Which is the worst thing. That's like being your own lawyer.
Oh, yeah. It's very hard because you don't see where something might be unclear because it's perfectly clear to you.
Well, obviously.
Yeah. But then somebody else might go, this sentence just doesn't jive. And you're like, well, why not? And see, that's why it helps to have outside editors.
Sure.
And of course, these big authors always have like 16 editors.
Exactly.
You know, we have ourselves and maybe a couple other people.
Who happen to be friends and wouldn't want to hurt our feelings.
Right. And so it's more challenging. Exactly. But I mean, just as we can translate words, literally our experiences are translated into internal senses and then retranslated back into an expression. And it's oftentimes really difficult to explain to somebody something that you saw. I often experience this one, where I have a dream and I know everything what happened, but then when I try to say what happened to somebody, I try to describe my dream, I can't remember any of it. I'm like, I have it in my head. I can picture the whole thing, but then when I try to explain it, it's like everything's missing.
Right, because we see our dreams in pictures instead of words, so it's very
exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's a 100% internal brain experience.
Right.
And so it's very difficult to translate that into a verbal expression that somebody else will understand.
Sure.
Now, here's another thing, and this is the most important part of like memory and communication, in my opinion, because you can really pinpoint people with this one. And I have no doubt in my mind that interrogators use this against people who are being interrogated. But what is known as lateral eye movements, LEM, in neurological literature. So here I'll start with this. What is the first thing you see as you walk through the front door of your home? Okay, so everyone probably thought of it.
Sure.
To answer that question, you probably looked up and to your left without even knowing it. Looking up and left is how most right-handed people remember images. Now really get in touch with how it would feel to have velvet next to your skin. Here you probably looked down and to your right, which is the way the majority of people get in touch with their feelings. There is actually a systematic way our eyes move to retrieve neurological messages from the brain. So when you see somebody kind of looking around as they're speaking to you and you look around yourself, you are doing what's called retrieval. And your eyes and brain are literally this system that is required to even communicate. You have to do this with your eyes. Now, what's interesting is most people will follow the following pattern, or they'll adhere to this pattern. When we visualize something, we stare straight ahead. If we have a visual constructed image, so I'm thinking of maybe Hitler speaking in front of an American audience. Okay, I have to come up with that.
Or if you're lying. If you're lying.
Exactly. If somebody is lying, they're going to be looking up and to the left. So you will know that if somebody is, if your kid, you
to
ask
your
them,
left,
did you do heroin last night, and they're mm-hmm. looking up and to their left.
To your left.
Yeah, yeah. When you're looking at them, they're going to be looking up and left.
Right.
Looking at them. Now, if they're remembering, they're going to be looking up and to the right. As you're looking at them, it will be up and right.
Right.
They'll be actually looking left.
Because they're remembering something rather
exactly.
than making something up.
Exactly. So, parents, if your child is being grilled and you see them looking up and left, they're lying to you. If they're looking up and to the right, then they're telling the truth and they're actually remembering something legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
Constructed sounds. So I'm imagining what it would sound like to have a grizzly bear right in front of me. I'm going to be looking straight across to the left. Mm-hmm. I'm not. I'm going to be looking right, but the person seeing me will see me looking left.
Right.
Remembered sound.
Exactly.
I know, it's kind of hard. You have to have the book, and it's page 36. And right. they show little smiley faces. Remembered sounds. So I'm actually remembering what my horse sounds like before I feed her.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to see the person looking straight across right.
Mm-hmm.
Kinesthetic. Feelings and bodily sensations. You'll see the person looking down and left. And then auditory digital, this is internal dialogue where you tell someone, say in your head, I'm going to sell this today. Mm-hmm. They're going to be looking down and right. So I just thought these were really interesting because I personally didn't know that we used eye movements to retrieve data or to construct
images. I took this class when I used to be on the road before I became a quilter. I was a salesperson. And it was always very interesting to be able to recognize how to approach different people. Some
uh-huh.
people, depending on their perceptions, you would want to appeal to whatever their preference was. For
right.
instance, can you see yourself in this car, or can you see yourself in this dress, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was awful, it was really important to be able to sell to a person in the way that they preferred, and to be able to talk to them and recognize how they were feeling about what you were saying.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And of course, if somebody gets suddenly pale and their eyes widen, you're going to know they're like, oh my.
They're zoned out. They're not
you
even
know.
Listening to you.
Yeah. Are you a Nazi? Get all pale, eyes get big.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I actually had that one time where my teacher, I was like, whoa. She actually asked me, Veronica, are you a Nazi? I just like was, oh my, the whole class is looking at me and I'm sure I turned white. My eyes got all big.
Oh,
like, no.
Wow.
It's kind of funny. Of course I'm not. I describe myself as a paleoliberal. And people can look up paleoliberalism. It would be the liberalism of the past with conservative tinges. I looked it up a while back and I'm like, that is me to the T. And I oftentimes think that National Socialism is very incorrectly described as right wing.
Oh, absolutely.
and conservative. No, it wasn't. It fits more paleoliberal ideology than it does conservative or right wing. So people should look up paleoliberal.
I am.
If they want. I knew you would be. Okay, so now submodalities. Now, so far we've talked about the three main ways of thinking: sounds, pictures, and feelings, but this is only the first step. If I wanted to describe a picture I've seen, there's a lot of detail I could add to that. Well, he had bushy eyebrows, a brow ring in his left eyebrow, brown eyes, dyed blonde hair, brown roots, some facial hair. You can kind of picture that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but here's some more. Was the picture you made in color or black and white? Now, of course, if I'm going to say he had brown eyes, you're going to see in color more than likely.
Right.
Here's another thing. Was it a moving film strip or still? Did you see this dude walking along, maybe talking? Or was it just a flat picture, just an image, a still shot? And then was it far away or near in your head? Did you see the face up close? Did you see it distant? These distinctions are made regardless of what's in the picture. And it's also the same for sound. Is it high or low pitched, near or far? How about lighting? You know, feelings. We can actually imagine what it would be like to try to hold an anvil. You know, our hand literally very quickly gets smashed under the anvil in our head. These are all these different little distinctions are called submodalities in NLP literature. And it's literally the feelings, sensations, etc., the fine details of our memory, of our representational systems. So visual would be, for example, distance of self from picture, location, depth, movement, clarity. And here's a very interesting one. Associated, seen through our own eyes, or dissociated, looking on itself. I tend to see myself in my memories and in my head. I'll see myself doing something. I'm very rarely associated in my memories, which is kind of interesting. It also tells people a little bit about personalities. If you ask someone, do you tend to remember things as though you're reenacting them? Or do you see yourself having it happen to you? I had a really bad car accident once. And I'll tell you what, I cannot associate with that memory because every feeling comes back. Mm. I was completely conscious the whole time. I never lost consciousness. Horrifying experience. Just horrifying. But I can't even associate with it because it just, I literally get very upset and I get the jitters. It just totally changes my whole being and I get like severe anxiety. So if I ever get a flashback memory of that, which they periodically just come, I don't know why, but I will always immediately step back out of the memory and just see myself crashing as though I'm a witness to it. Mm. And that, I don't get the feeling, not at all. So that's very interesting, and that would be visual. So for those who have had a very painful experience, molestation, a rape, maybe they were robbed and somebody held a gun to their head, NLP therapy teaches you the technique visually of making that memory small in your brain, distant, black and white, and dissociated.
Mm-hmm.
You are witnessing it from afar, and it is much, much easier to deal with the memory that way.
Go ahead. Some people disassociate when something terrible is happening to them.
Yes.
In order to not feel the pain or the fear of what is going on.
Absolutely. And when it becomes a complex, They call it dissociative disorder, or what used to be called multiple personality disorder.
Right.
And it is very real. Everybody in NLP teaches you this has multiple personalities. For example, if I meet a stranger, I am not going to tell them who I really am and what I really believe, and until I can trust them and I know them. This is my shallow personality. This is my facade I wear in the midst of untrustworthy strangers. If I get to know someone more and I trust them fully, and we've been friends maybe 10 years, they're going to know everything about me, pretty much, unless there's something I want to withhold, which if one has a true, true best friend, one generally doesn't withhold anything from them because they're absolute unconditional acceptance of you. That would be your true self, because you're expressing all of your many dimensions to that person. But we all have multiple personalities, but sometimes that can develop into an actual complex where somebody can turn off and on very strange personas within themselves. Mm-hmm. The best example would be Sybil.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, very interesting. But that's true. When somebody, oftentimes young children who have been molested multiple times, they will dissociate from the entire experience as it's happening.
Sure.
They are not there. So yeah, yep. And that's the human's way of dealing with trauma. That is programmed into us so that we can survive a traumatic experience. If we didn't have that, we'd all be suicidal.
Sure.
More than likely, because it's too much. And then, of course, auditory, fine details, auditory. Is it stereo or mono? Is it words or sounds? How's the volume? Loud or soft? Tone, soft or harsh? Just different, you know, distance, duration, etc. Speed. These are all auditory distinctions. And then kinesthetic would be like location, intensity, extent, how big, texture, rough or smooth, temperature, shape, those kind of things. And again, those are submodalities of our preferred representational systems.
Right. And we all go in and out of these things. For instance, if we hear a song from a movie, then we can remember the movie, and we can remember who we sat with and whether we had popcorn or whatever. We can just go back to that particular moment just from hearing that song.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yep. And
remember the guy that broke our heart.
Yeah. That's right. So, yeah, good point. And then, of course, just a few different examples of sensory-based words and phrases. Visual might be look, picture, focus. Auditory, say, accent, rhythm. Kinesthetic, touch, handle, contact. Neutral, which is generally what we encounter in unbiased history, decide, think,
as if there
remember.
Were such a thing.
Unless you're a jutsu, then you want to, you definitely want to grasp the emotional aspect.
Right.
So yeah, these should be neutral, like meditate, recognize, attend, decide. They don't have any attachment to them. Olfactory, stale, nosy, fragrant, smoky. And then gustatory, sour, flavor, bitter. And again, the good writer and the good storyteller will try to draw on all of these. And then visual phrases, and I'm very much this way. I see what you mean. We see eye to eye. He has a blind spot. Show me what you mean. You'll look back on this and laugh. It appears to me. And then beyond a shadow of a doubt. Those are just a few.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that a visual person is stupid. It's that they think in visual terms.
Right.
I see what you mean. They're not dumb when they say, I see what you mean. Because I've actually had people go, how do you see what I mean? And I'm like, really? I'm flabbergasted at their response. And it's like, what? This is weird. So when visual people encounter one another, they'll tend to click. It just, they hit it off. Mm-hmm. When kinesthetic people talk to each other, they'll hit it off. But then when the visual talks to the kinesthetic and says, I see what you mean, the kinesthetic's like, no, you don't.
Right.
And they don't quite get it.
So to introduce a little bit of familiarity or so that they can feel more comfortable with you, uh-huh. you can mirror their actions, not in any
exactly.
kind of obvious way, but yes. just in a very subtle way so that they feel like you understand or you're
absolutely.
Part of what they're saying.
Yes, mirroring is very important. And that's when, you know, we'll kind of hear each other out to people and then we'll start to mirror and get on their level, on their mm-hmm. plane. Auditory phrases would be like on the same wavelength, living in harmony, a lot of mumbo jumbo, rings a bell, unheard of, hold your tongue, loud and clear. Mm-hmm. So that's how those people would speak. And then kinesthetic, I will get in touch with you. I can grasp that idea. Hold on a second. A cool customer. Thick-skinned. And how about smooth operator?
Ah. Yes.
And then olfactory and gustatory. Smell a rat. A bitter pill. A taste for the good life. And an acid comment.
Mm-hmm.
So those would be the different examples. Let's see. I guess the next thing I will go to is physiological states and emotional freedom. We are what and how we think. So if a person always thinks about things in their past that are depressing, it will make them depressed in the present. And we've kind of already touched on this in our last talk on this.
Mm-hmm.
One must deal with these problems of remembering. And it really is just remembering. It isn't happening to you still. But because you remember it, it literally changes your whole state in the present. We need to learn how to liberate ourselves, how to come to an emotional freedom so that we don't allow past harmful memories or experiences to dictate the rest of our lives, basically,
right.
in our present state. So the book just goes through different methods of dealing with that. And of course, one can really go into NLP and actually either get the therapy or buy books that will help them do self-therapy. And of course, it's probably online too.
Sure. And I think that every one of us has had bad experiences in the past. But we have to learn to get beyond them so that it does not impact our current situation. And sure. I've heard people say, well, this happened to this person 10 years ago, and she just, that's why she drinks, or that's why she's so unhappy. And I think, they just never left that experience.
Mm-hmm.
Did they not want to? Did they not know how to get beyond it? Do they just recall it because they like the sympathy that they receive, or they mm-hmm. like to feel sad? It's kind of interesting to kind of figure this out.
Oh, yeah. And I believe that every single addiction or anything like that, depression, alcoholism, etc., it can all be traced to one's childhood experiences. And generally, I mean, I would guess at least 95% of all addictions are the result of being raised in a dysfunctional family atmosphere. So some kind of dysfunction starts, and it is indeed passed down the generations. And oftentimes dysfunction was rooted in immigration, because what I've found is a lot of people I talk to that have like addictions in their families but have been able to overcome them, they'll say, yeah, my great-great-grandparents were immigrants from, say, Poland or Germany or even England. And because that was such a traumatic experience and it was so hard and they worked like these long days, great-great-great-grandpa or great-great-grandpa such-and-such started drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And then that affects great or just grandpa such and such, he started drinking or he maybe started doing drugs or whatever. And then that's why my father or my mother do this. And you'll see it literally pass down the generations.
Oh, absolutely.
Uh-huh. And it really helps a person who's struggling with an addiction to literally, if they can, trace it in their family and pinpoint where it started. It makes it easier to get over it.
Sure.
Because people have to ask, what is it that happened in my life and my childhood that made me an alcoholic or made me a codependent? And once one finds the root cause, it's just easier to deal with it. You can go, okay, this is where it started. I'm not going to blame my ancestors. I'm not going to blame my father, etc. I own it now. I'm going to overcome it and stop the cycle. And it's some people can do it and others can't. I'd say the majority never get over their addictions. But there's those very strong people that have that strong willpower, and they tend to be the ones that really have revolutionary change, not only in their own lives, but they go on to be like social workers, psychologists and whatnot that help other people. And it's always good for an ex-addict to help addicts, I think. They tend to be the best counselors, especially when it comes to drugs. It's very difficult for a person who's never done drugs to counsel someone who's using heroin or whatever.
Well, you will find that a lot of people who go into social work or to psychology or something do so in order to help themselves.
Yep.
And in doing that, then they figure out how to help other people. So,
right. Absolutely. Yeah. Right. And I found that ex-addicts can nail the liars easier. They know when an addict is lying.
Sure,
they know the
because
patterns.
They've done it themselves.
Exactly. And a person who hasn't lived in it and hasn't done it, they just aren't as savvy. So yes, absolutely. And then I guess we can go on to the next thing, which is elicitation or changing moods. This is a word used in NLP to describe the process of guiding someone into a particular state. So hypnotists would use elicitation, putting them into different moods or bringing them out of moods. Let's try a technique to get you out of your current depressive state. Okay, that would be what a therapist might start asking you, your last family vacation or something good that happened to you, and they'll start trying to elicit a mood change so that you can deal with whatever you're struggling with. If you are trying to put someone in a calm, resourceful state, it is useless talking in a loud, fast tone, breathing quickly and shallowly, and making lots of fidgety movements. Obviously, you're just going to make them feel anxiety, even though your words may be soothing. So your whole being has to change. You have to be calm and resourceful when you're speaking to someone to bring them into that mood. I've oftentimes had people tell me that I have a drawl and that my voice brings them to a very calm state. I'm like, I do not have a drawl.
Yeah, I was thinking, maybe drawl? I don't.
Maybe I do. Maybe
drawl.
I have that California drawl. My brother used to make fun of me. He's all, you say shut up. Do not say shut up. So then I got a big complex about it. I didn't want to talk to anybody. But a lot of people have told me that your voice is very soothing. I just like to listen to you talk.
That's nice.
Let's see.
Go ahead. Self-hypnosis too.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. My mom actually did self-hypnosis for a while. And it does work. And you're not hypnotized and going to go murder for someone or walking around like a zombie. Hypnosis isn't like that. It's a literal transformation of state.
Right.
And it's amazing when it happens. But the closest thing I can describe when one is truly in a hypnotic state is like deja vu. When all of a sudden you have that feeling like, oh my gosh, I've been here before in this exact context. With her here saying this very thing,
right.
It's very weird. I've had deja vu a few times in my life, and it's like, whoa. I mean, it really is fascinating. It just completely changes your present state, and you're all of a sudden in that other time.
Right.
When it already happened, or sometimes when you dreamed about it and it actually happens.
Right. And we're not talking about MK Ultra here. We're talking about using it in a beneficial, satisfying, helpful way when you're trying to help somebody or yourself.
Exactly. Exactly.
Not when you're trying to murder the president or something.
Right, right. Yeah. And I mean, yeah, it can be used as a weapon, certainly. And that would be actual mind control and changing someone's whole thinking and perception and getting them to do something that they would never otherwise do.
Right.
That's just full-on manipulation. And then it is important, too, that the person remembers the experience as if inside it, if you're trying to change their mood. Mm-hmm. Not dissociated.
Right.
So I wouldn't want to be watching myself doing an activity. I would want to be actually doing it or actually feeling it. So right. I'm associated.
Like at the beach, and you can hear the waves and they're just splashing against the shore.
Right. I am actually there seeing that right
exactly.
now.
Exactly. And feeling it. You're feeling that. You're feeling it. And you're hearing the music, the sounds. Yeah.
The cool breeze.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The palm trees.
Right. Okay, so then the next thing would be calibration, knowing states. So calibration is the NLP word that means recognizing when people are in different states. Generally, we can all tell when somebody close to us is depressed, happy, withholding something, kind of standoffish, unsure. Mm-hmm. Anxious, okay, that's knowing states, but also knowing your own states, knowing when you're depressed, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Some people aren't even aware that they're depressed. They just think everything is awful, everyone's out to get me, the world is so horrible, my job stinks.
Those things could all be true.
But here's the thing, I have that context sometimes, but
right.
I don't feel depressed about it.
Okay.
So what is it about me that I don't feel depressed about my lousy job, bad economy, terrible situation, whatever. And the other person who has the same exact thing is ready to jump off a bridge.
Right.
Why? That's knowing states, not only in oneself, but in other people.
Sure.
We really should know when our children are contemplating suicide and depressed. So those of you who have kids, you need to be in touch. You need to know their state. And every teenager goes through, I hate the world. I hate you. I'm depressed. They all go through it. But, you know, you have to be there and kind of know when they're in these different states.
And we've often heard, at least I've heard, of wives who have sensed that their husband was being unfaithful.
Yeah, among other things.
Right.
Just knowing something like, for example, there are people that know when somebody gets in an accident. They'll know that a family member is in danger. It's very weird. But let me give you two examples. Me and my mother are extremely close. I'm fortunate to still have her. Extremely close. And there was one time when I was I was literally almost at my house, and I used to ride a motorcycle. And I advise everyone not to. Do not ride a motorcycle. They are so dangerous. But I crashed it. First time I've ever done it. And it was pretty bad. I mean, the bike was totaled. The front of it was mangled. And I flipped over the handlebars and actually took one of the handlebars in the gut.
My goodness.
It left a massive bruise, too. She knew I got in an accident before she even saw me and was already walking down the hill from her house. She said, I knew you crashed. And I'm like, how is that possible? She just knew. And she never, ever, ever took a midday walk. Ever. It just didn't happen. That day it did.
Hmm.
That's one thing. And of course, she saw me.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second time, this gal literally drove right into my truck. She pulled out of her driveway. It didn't even look. And she admits this later, right? And she pulls into me and hits me. I call on the phone and my mom says, don't tell me you got in an accident. I said, how did you know? She said, I just knew. And it was the first and only time my truck has ever been wrecked. And it wasn't my fault.
Wow.
It's not my fault. But and it wasn't serious. It didn't do a thing to my truck. But man, her car was mangled. And if I had not turned the wheel and swung to where the bed hit her door, I would have T-boned her directly right into her door. And I'm 99% sure she would have died because I'm in a 3/4 ton pickup. And she was in this little plastic car like they make now. So I was very glad I turned the wheel. But anyway, just when people are very close, and this can even happen with spouses, they can telepathically know each other's states. And this would be an example. I know when somebody's depressed far away and I'll give them a call.
Mm-hmm.
It's very weird. And they'll go, oh my God, I am so glad you called. I have been feeling depressed lately. And it's like, how did I know?
Mm-hmm.
And I've had the same thing happen to me from other people where they were just knowing how I felt. It's just weird.
Mm-hmm.
But that's knowing states. And I very much believe that one can know states even though they're not even in the vicinity of the person.
Right. And you have to think, is it intuition? Is it just some inherent kind of a quality, a characteristic that we have, that we can be in touch with those people that are close to us? Yeah, it's
right. And what's interesting is many identical twins that have been separated at birth and didn't know about each other, but found one another and reunited,
mm-hmm.
they knew each other existed.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was never conveyed to them. That's
right.
Another example. Just very interesting. Okay, so moving on, anchors. So anchors are literally methods or things, objects, for example, one can use to get into a state quickly. So let's say I'm a public speaker and I need to be in a positive, very confident, resourceful state, quick recall ability, ready to go, no nervousness, no stage fright. I would work on anchoring before that big event by maybe taking a certain posture, maybe holding my hand a certain way, a closed fist that's always the same. Whenever I put myself into that state, or whenever I feel that state, I'll do this movement or I'll think a certain way. That then becomes an anchor to bring that state on deliberately, systematically. And you'll see oftentimes like a ritual that maybe a baseball player will do,
mm-hmm.
or like, who's that one amazing tennis player? Serena Williams,
mm-hmm.
she probably has anchors. You'll see her do a certain thing. Maybe she has a dance she does, some ritual.
Mm-hmm.
Holds her racket a certain way, maybe prays before. There's always something they'll do to prepare for their game or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And one will notice these patterns. That is anchoring to bring on a state.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important that people do this because you can switch it off and on. So very valuable to have it. Maybe you're having a lot of fights with a spouse and you want to be able to calm yourself and not scream and yell. You would come up with, systematically train yourself to be calm with a certain anchor. And then when the fight starts escalating, you go, okay, I'm going to sit in my chair that I've been training myself to sit in and be calm and resourceful and just listen and not talk or yell. And that would be your anchor.
Or throw anything.
Right. One would hope not. Or, you know, swing fists. We always want to avoid that one. Okay, so yeah, very good. Very good example. And then, of course, extreme cases where a very, an overwhelming negative state can be formed, that's a phobia. So when somebody sees a black widow and they scream and jump and, oh my God, you know, those
right.
people have an anchor. That's an anchor. It's an anchor for an immediate anxiety-ridden, screaming, terror-ridden feeling. That can happen. So that would be another example. And of course, there is a phobia cure that we'll get to that's kind of interesting to overcome that. But again, it's simply changing state. So, and of course, the spider itself would be the anchor in that example. So a stimulus which is linked to and triggers a physiological state is called an anchor in NLP. And then, of course, one can come up with other associations. For example, if we're driving along and we suddenly see a police car in our rear view mirror, most of us will get tense and like, oh my gosh, is my registration current? Do I look okay?
Am I speeding?
Is my license plate?
Right.
Exactly. It's just trigger. It's a triggered response. You could be perfectly innocent, but you feel guilty simply because the police car is a trigger.
Right.
It's an association we've made. Cops equal trouble.
Yes.
So that would be like an association in NLP. And of course, we can choose the associations we want to make. Okay, I don't want to feel like I'm terror-ridden and completely scared whenever I see a black widow. I'm going to overcome this association.
See, you, in California, black widows are very prevalent.
Oh, they're everywhere.
And when I was growing up in Sacramento, we moved into a new house that was on farmland. They had, sold this farm. Mm-hmm. And my goodness, there were black widows all over this farm. And and as a consequence, they came into your house.
Oh, yeah. They're everywhere.
And it was very scary. I mean, you could be in your bedroom and look up on the wall and see a black widow. And it was yep. so frightening to me that, I can really relate to black widows. But
right. In
Illinois, we don't have any black widows.
Oh, wow. See, that's so weird to me.
Yeah.
But again, that's my perception. I can't imagine a world without pincher bugs and black widows.
Oh, pincher bugs. Absolutely. Those
They're
were
everywhere.
Very prevalent, too.
Those things are taken off.
Yes.
They really are. They're everywhere. Yeah, every time we lift a cup or turn on the kitchen light at like 12 midnight or something, if you have to get up and get a glass of water,
sure.
Pincher bugs just scatter.
Yikes.
Right. Well, me being in the area I am, I'm very acclimated to bugs. They're just everywhere. I mean, we have moths flying in the house, bugs everywhere. The pincher bugs are just swarming here. You'll pick up a cup and there's a pincher bug in it.
Yikes.
You'll be like feeling something crawling down your side of your face and you're like, oh,
yikes.
Pincher bug. I had one the other day. It was crawling down my face. And I freaked out.
Well, I was on the radio program one day and it was quite a large spider, ran across my desk. I have no idea where he came from.
Lovely.
And I said, eek, there's a spider.
Right. But see, that's that association.
And
so there you go. Spider anchor for fear.
Exactly. And somebody emailed me and they said, you have got to have dried lavender anywhere where you have where spiders seem to be,
okay. And
that will dispel them. They don't want to be anywhere near dried lavender. So I have in my office, I have a couple of vases filled with dried lavender. I have one in my bedroom, I have not seen any spiders in my office, except for two little tiny, tiny jumping spiders,
mm-hmm.
which were up on the ceiling. And I could barely wait until the break was on so that I could have 3 minutes to murder the spider.
Swat them off the wall.
That's what I did.
Yeah. Yeah, we have these little flies here. They're very cute, actually. They have a long neck. Their little face will turn at you.
Oh,
it's
my.
Almost like a little tiny dragonfly / fly. They fly, and it has kind of a long body with a little pointy tail. I don't know what they are, but they land on us all the time at work. And they just hang out on you, look at you. You can put your finger up to them, and they'll kind of nibble on your finger. And I'm like, they're cute. So we do have some cute bugs that we'd like to hang. And I've heard that daddy long legs kill black widows.
Oh, they do.
So daddy long legs, harmless, keep them around.
They also go after ants. If you have ants, they'll go after the ants.
Oh, very good. Very good. Okay, so moving on here.
Enough with our bugs.
Yeah. But we all know those are anchors now. Generally,
yes.
Anchors for fear. Using your resourceful states through anchors is one of the most effective ways to change your own and other people's behavior. So we can actually change not only ourselves, but others. And resourceful states are the key to peak performance. So when you change what you do, others will change in accord with that.
I think that's kind of scriptural.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So very, very important. And of course, our emotional states can be transferred to other people. So if someone's feeling depressed and we're not depressed, we can bring them up. We can transfer our emotional state to them. Let's see, what else have we got? Of course, we've already talked about associating anchors. So say I want to, here's an example. Every time I do a radio show, I have my cup of coffee, my glass of water, and I'm sitting in a wicker chair. If I were to put myself in a different context and not be on my same computer and have my glass of water, my coffee, and that kind of, just the effect of the caffeine, etc., I may not do a radio show as well as I normally do. So these are all anchors for me when I'm performing on radio, kind of a thing. Right. So this is literally associating my anchors to control my state.
Right.
And people can use this for anything.
Like you feel sharper mentally when you're sitting up straight in a chair at a desk. Yep. And with me, it's kombucha and water.
Uh-huh.
Then I also have my shoes off so that I can put my bare feet on my earthing pad under the desk.
Nice. I can picture that. I see and what you're saying.
So I heard you. I hear you.
Very good.
Yes. So you're right. Depending on the positioning that we adopt, will help us to be alert or not alert. Certainly, if we were lounging around on a couch, if I were, I probably wouldn't be as mentally alert.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's just another example. And one can also chain multiple anchors. So it doesn't have to just be one thing you do. It can be a series of things you do. And in my case, I have several things I'm doing. And I'm always on the same computer, my newer HP.
Oh.
I'm still a desktop person, by the way.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if anyone's seen the epic rap battles of history on YouTube, but there's a good one. Bill Gates versus Steve Jobs, PC versus Apple. You got to watch it.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
I'm a PC person.
Oh,
not
I am
that I
too.
Support Bill Gates, but.
No, I don't support him at all, but I do.
But
like
I do. I'm a PC person still. I hate tablets. I've been resisting them. I just hate. I don't like not having the mouse. I'm kinesthetic that way. I need my mouse.
I need a mouse too.
I can't stand the little just touching, moving your finger on it or touch screen.
I just don't feel in control if I don't have my mouse.
Mm-hmm. Right. And also cell phones. I don't own a cell phone. And
I do have a cell phone. This is how I would use my cell phone. I use it like once a month.
Uh-huh.
But now, the only thing that I use it for, I have it in my bedroom. It's on the table next to my side of the bed. I have my gun in the drawer with my bullets.
Nice.
This is my safe room so that if I hear somebody come up the stairs, mm-hmm. I will call the police on my cell phone. That is the only thing that I would use my cell phone for.
Very
because
good.
Because typically they would cut your telephone lines.
Right.
So that's why you need a cell phone to put next to your side of the bed.
Good point. Right.
Other
now,
than
I
that,
have heard that you're not supposed to have it too close to you when you're sleeping or plugged in or there's something about it because it pulses all night.
Absolutely. You don't have it on. Ever.
Right. Okay. You don't have it on. That's
right.
What it was.
Because I got rid of all the electricity in the bedroom. I do have one clock that's far away so I can see what time it is.
Right.
But I don't have anything in there that's, you know.
Very good.
I don't have any energy frequencies or anything like that.
The only thing we do have the wireless. And it's, you know, I turn my computers off, but.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of nerve-wracking having that beaming through the house all day because, you know, my sister's got a computer, mom's got one, I have my two, and they're constantly talking to that stupid little, you know, double antenna thing, the router.
Right.
And it's like, I just wonder, I'm sure it's not good.
Oh, it isn't good. That's why you need to be earthed.
Yeah. I have to work on that one. I thought about just going back to DSL. What is the option?
There's not a lot of options. I mean, I do have
How's
a router.
DSL?
I do have a router.
Okay.
And I have, there's three other computers in the house except for the one here on my desk.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why I really advocate earthing, because earthing kind of counters those electrical frequencies.
Right. Okay. And that's pretty much the only option. I thought DSL was less of a threat because it's actually still through a phone line and you have
right.
to still plug it in. But I will say, I'm proud to say that I got two smart meter guards.
Oh, good for you.
My
no.
mom will not get the meters taken off. I'm like, it's only $10 a month. No, no. I'm like, all right, we'll get the smart meter guards. It's just an average American guy makes a very simple, basically Faraday box out of stainless steel that goes over the smart meter.
Really?
And because it's grounded on the back, one only needs to cover the glass part. So I got two of those. And, you know, I felt good supporting him. He answered all my questions. And his site is something like smartmeterguard.com. Very simple little device. One can make their own. And he says that. But I wanted to support him. So, yeah, we put two of those on and it's good to go.
Good.
But I do not like those smart meters on the house. And I made a point of calling the electric company and saying, we bought two smart meter guards for your death race smart meter. I was really rude.
Oh, good.
I said, so don't you throw them away. I said, is this going to be a problem? And he's all, let me speak to my supervisor. I said, you better. And I said, I just want to let you know that we don't like your radiation cancer meters. You know, you have to be a little rude to the electric companies and let them know you know what's up.
Sure.
I've been on an anti-GMO crusade for a while now, and I'm writing or calling all these companies and asking them, are you GMO? And then when they answer back, I say, either great for you, we're changing your product, or we're never going to buy another thing made by you ever again. Bye.
Right.
And generally, companies will take the opinion of one person and assume that that represents thousands, at least 1,000 people. So it does make a difference, and we should all do it. By the way, Barilla pasta, non-GMO.
Oh, good. That's so. I use that kind, but I don't eat pasta anymore unless it's gluten-free. So,
right. Now, I don't know if Barilla is gluten-free,
no,
but I can say that Karo, GMO, all GMO, everything Karo makes. So stay away from their nasty Monsanto corn syrup.
Oh, I used regular. I use pure corn. Oh, that Karo. Oh, yeah. I don't use that.
K-A-R-O.
Right.
Yeah, that corporation. They're all, oh, we're all GMO. I said, okay, then bye.
Yes.
Yeah.
I use natural maple syrup and
so. Right. We've switched to just 100% honey.
Yes.
A little bit of honey on your pancake, and it's pure organic pancake mix. Don't touch Bisquick either.
Yeah.
GMO. Okay, so getting back to anchors. I know we're all off on a tangent. Okay, so anchors
it's important
need,
stuff.
It is. Anchors need to be timed just as the state is reaching its peak. Unique and distinctive. Easy to repeat exactly, like clenching the fist in a certain way or whatever. And linked to a state that is cleanly and completely re-experienced. So it takes practice to bring on a state using anchors. And of course, one has to identify the situation where one would want to be more resourceful. So if I'm a public speaker, I'm going to want to identify that as the situation in which I don't want to be nervous. I want to be very confident. And so my anchors are going to be geared towards confidence. That's going to be my state that is invoked by my anchors. And I'm sure Hitler had many anchors before he spoke.
Right.
I'm still fascinated by the guy's public speaking. It's just incredible.
It's amazing. Absolutely
it really
amazing.
Is. It really is. And you'll kind of see him like he does the hair thing a lot. You notice the bangs. He'll push his bangs
right,
to the side.
Right.
I think that might have been a Hitler anchor. Just push my bangs back and I'm good to go. Okay, so then we've already talked about chaining anchors, and of course, you know, that's where you have more than one that are chained together.
Mm-hmm.
And then also collapsing anchors. Okay, so if one wants to turn off the feeling, get rid of a state, you need to learn how to collapse your anchors and get out of that state.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to come down after a big public speech, calm down, you know, be more in a conversational, calm state,
mm-hmm.
whatever it might be. You're going to want to have your performance anchor collapsed. Another very interesting concept in NLP is what's called change personal history. Now, as we've gone over, our experience only exists in the present moment. We do not actually experience future or past, only present. It is always only right now, this moment. We only experience other things through memory or projection. The past exists as memories, and to remember these, we have to re-experience them in some way in our present. And then the future exists only as expectations or fantasies, again created in the present. Anchoring enables us to increase our emotional freedom by escaping from the tyranny of either past negative experiences and creating a more positive future. So it's very important, or reliving positive experiences from the past. If we're feeling depressed now, say we lose a parent and we're just in a devastated state, maybe you can remember good times you were having with your mom or dad, etc., and have that bring up your present state. So you can use either. It can either be positive or negative experiences from the past.
Mm-hmm.
But when we anchor, we literally use these to change our personal history, to reevaluate past memories in the light of present knowledge, for example. So this is just another application of anchoring. So the method they go through is you identify the negative state, elicit it, calibrate to it, anchor it, and then break state. So if I was going to remember a time when, say, just hypothetically, I was beaten by somebody and it kept bothering me, I would anchor that to a certain place in my house, maybe sitting on my couch, certain feeling, certain state, totally associate with it, etc., and then immediately break it. I get up off the couch, change state, jump up and down, maybe go for a walk around the yard, take in everything beautiful. I'm now in an uplifted state. That's what we're doing. We're
mm-hmm.
changing personal history by having that bad memory or whatever, and then breaking it and going into a whole new state with new anchors.
Mm-hmm.
This is literally where you can turn it on and off. So
mm-hmm.
you start to remember when you were molested or beaten or whatever the bad memory might be. Maybe you were using heroin and it keeps coming back to haunt you. You would learn how to break state.
Mm-hmm.
So you get yourself back in that memory, but then break state.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps people overcome those. And it's never easy. I mean, this is a long process. Therapy is always a long process.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think NLP has some really good techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's also future pacing. So experiencing a situation before it happens. I found that I think it's very important for people to, especially women, to imagine in the future being attacked or raped, because if you can future project how that incident would be, you can control it if it actually happens. You
right.
really have to see it and live it, really associate with it in your head as though it's going to happen in the future, so that you are better protected to defend yourself if that situation ever comes. And when you've been there and done it in your head, associated, and it actually happens, you're not going to panic and freak out and not know what to do. You're going to have more clarity. You're going to be able to respond rationally. You're going to remember, scream fire, hit, do not just lay there.
Well, there's
you know,
some mental.
Gouge his eyes out kind of a thing.
The mental preparation and the attitude of being a victim
right.
And your awareness. If you're aware or if you're texting and you don't know what's going on around you, you become very vulnerable. You can become a victim more readily than if you're totally aware of your circumstances. And as far as picturing, you know, myself, what I would do, mm-hmm. they just pass conceal carry in my mm-hmm. state.
Yep.
So
right.
I thought, hey, I get to carry a gun.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess another important thing would be to train yourself. And this is brought up in the book, The Psychology of Persuasion, Influence.
Oh, yes.
By Robert Cialdini. We can just start bringing this in now.
Sure.
This guy actually goes through rape scenarios. Great, great book. I would recommend it to everybody. And it's very cheap used. But he talks about click whir responses. For example, if one is to put a little fake polecat on a string, which is like a ferret, and you come at a turkey with this little polecat, the turkey will freak out. The mother turkey will just attack this little polecat and rip it up. But if you bring the little polecat towards the turkey and have it make a cheep, cheep noise, just like a little baby turkey, mm-hmm. the mother will just bring it right on in the nest and coddle it like
Amazing.
It's one of her own chicks. That is what is called an inherent click whir response.
Ah.
So in future pacing, one would want to train oneself mentally, and one could even take a couple martial art classes or just practice it with another person. Click whir, where, okay, a guy takes you down and click whir without even thinking, you kick him in the genitals or gouge his eyes out or push up on his nose. You can literally, with the palm of your hand, no matter how weak you are, break someone's nose and jam that bone straight up into their brain.
Exactly.
You can kill them with one hit.
Yes.
And believe you me, you hit a dude in that nose, he's going to be down in that perfect upward palm plant.
Right.
So there are things you can do. They even tell you, do jam your fingers into his eye sockets and dig those eyes out.
You know, I don't know whether I could do that.
I think I could. If it was serious, I would be, I'm going to be ripping your eyes out, dudes.
Okay. So maybe I could, but it just seems so ghastly.
But I think an instinctual, just imagine what they're capable of. This creature that had those three girls, for example.
Exactly.
I think I could rip someone's eyes right out of their head just even thinking that could happen, where I could be someone's slave for 10 years. Ugh. He should have been shot on the spot, by the way.
Exactly.
Anyway, it should be a click whir response. So, mm-hmm. and of course, Cialdini in that book, Influence, goes through ways to turn off the click whir response. This is where, you know, the Hare Krishnas mm-hmm. used to accost people in the airport. They just put a flower, their silly little flower on you.
Mm-hmm.
Here, take our flower. Okay, they knew that when they gave you that flower, even though it was this 1 cent junky little flower, that you now felt obligated to reciprocate
to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. the giving. Right. Ah, here's a buck. Now leave me alone. And the people would literally throw the flower in the trash, like a ways down, and the Hare Krishnas would run to the trash can and pull them back out and stick them on another person at the
wow.
airport. They've since been banned from the airports for this very reason.
Well, I've seen traders in the Middle East when I was, in Israel.
Uh-huh.
And it was... It was the people, I guess they were, I'm trying to remember exactly what town, but they wanted you to hold the jewelry that they were trying to sell you.
Oh,
and that
no.
is one of the things that they do in order to make you feel ownership so that you would pay for it.
Ah, very interesting.
And this one merchant just forced it into my hand. So I just laid it down on the ground and walked away.
Mm-hmm.
And...
Good job.
That's the only thing I could think of doing.
Right. Very good. And see, they know that. They know that. And what you'll find, and this is so funny because I read this book before my mom got a pre-owned Camry. And we went to the dealership and I said, I'll bet you anything, because the salesman had left. I said, I'll bet you anything he comes back with a drink for you. Mm-hmm. Sure enough, he came back with a bottled water. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's in the Caldini book. And we were just laughing about it afterwards. Because he gave her something, she actually literally would feel obligated to buy the car.
Right.
Yes, I will trade you a bottle of water or a soda for a car.
Right.
And we really and truly will do it. And so when we understand these click-whir responses we have, the law of reciprocity, et cetera, anything,
mm-hmm.
we can go, wait a minute, I know what he's doing here. And you don't get mad at the salesman.
No.
Because they're not actually manipulating you. They're simply using principles of psychology that are already there that we do all the time to each other.
Right.
Plus, you just go, I'm not going to buy the car simply because you got me a bottle of water. You think that in your head. You go, I'm not going to let this decide the purchase.
But a lot of salespeople do take these classes, and they really do know how to operate. They really, really do.
They sure do. And so do servers.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when I see a good server. A good server in a restaurant will start, like if you ask about champagne or whatnot, something expensive. They'll go, well, we have this, this, and this. But, you know, might I recommend this is the slightly less expensive version. Also very good, but a little bit cheaper, or however they put it off.
Mm-hmm.
The person then thinks, oh, the server is trying to save me money.
Right.
What a sweetie pie. And they're more likely to buy more than one drink.
Sure.
And give a bigger tip. So they actually end up spending more money than they would if they bought the more expensive thing. So the server has actually gotten you for a higher tip and a higher overall ticket trying to sell you the cheaper thing or mm-hmm. selling the cheaper thing. So yes, these are all techniques
mm-hmm.
that people either learn on their own through experience or they're taught.
And somebody that is trying to sell you something really needs to make it obvious that it's to your benefit to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
When I was out on the road, I was in a store and the owner was talking to another salesperson whose appointment was right before mine, and mm-hmm. he said, "Oh, I really need to buy a new car, and I need to make some sales." And I'm thinking, "What an idiot!"
Mm-hmm.
He just told her what he needed without even expressing or showing any interest in what fabrics that she could use.
Mm-hmm.
That is the worst thing to do. When people come
right.
to the door and say, I'm trying to win a trip and I'm selling magazines, I thought, well, you're not going to win your trip by, I'm not buying your magazine.
Exactly.
I don't want your magazine just so you can go on a trip.
Yep.
So you really need to make it seem like it would be to their advantage to make a purchase.
Right. Exactly. And APAC is very good at it. I get their mailings, by the way.
Really?
I get APAC and the SPLC.
Ah.
I get all their hate news and all that. And I
Wonderful.
Just see what kind of methods they use. It's very easy to join the SPLC, by the way, people. Hint, hint, hint. $15 donation once a year. You'll get a membership card. And you can learn from the inside out what they're all about. It's not hard. I always thought, how would Morris Dees and the SPLC deal with the fact that a whole bunch of quote-unquote right-wing extremists were actually paid supporters? How would they explain that? They're fighting hate, and hate is paying their bills.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. I had actually proposed that a long time ago to one guy, and he's all, I can't believe you said that. And I'm like, what do you mean? What do you think Jutsis do? Do you think they stand back and go, don't join an NS organization or a fascist organization? Hi, David Cole.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing they do is get in there so that you learn the ropes and you learn the psychology and you're all buddy-buddy with them, and then you can undo them.
Right.
Exactly. So anyway, and I guess that can take us to our next thing, loops and systems in NLP. So as we know, human relationships are complex, and even in communication or relationships, it is a loop, and one doesn't know what to say or how to respond to anything without continuous feedback. So when we say something to somebody, I'm a paleoliberal, how is that person going to respond? Because however that person responds is going to be how I respond in turn, which isn't always unpredictable. So we're always kind of feeling each other out. What can I say? What should I do? How should I respond? Constant feedback. And it's just kind of interesting to understand communication and relationships in that respect, that it is a loop of responses and elicitations that are completely unpredictable. One can never know for sure how a conversation is going to go until it happens. So just kind of interesting. And then under that same category, there are two main ways of understanding experience and events. You can focus on the content, the information. What is this piece? What's it called? What does it look like? How is it like others? And this is understanding in depth needs another viewpoint, relationship, or context. So you have the actual content, and then you need relationship and context. And this is where, in at least in my opinion, it's very important to give history, events, context, and relationships to other points in history, and also understanding today's thinking versus yesterday's thinking. Mm-hmm. And this is the most difficult thing to get across to people. Back in the day, in the 1930s, there was still slavery in America, and Africans were totally discriminated against. That was the norm. Today, unacceptable. So when you go back in time and you're thinking about or writing about America or Germany or whatever, political movements, etc., to take on a New Age liberal Masonic Jutsist viewpoint is absurd. One can't do that and then try to apply it to the past. Well, they were all a bunch of racists, blah, blah, blah. We need to feel guilty. They should have been guilty. No, that was accepted during that time. Mm-hmm. So that's just one example. Very hard to get this across to people who are so brainwashed by today's Masonic Jutsism, but
sure,
that's how it is. And then, of course, learning loops, how we learn. We learn from mistakes much more than from successes. The mistakes in our lives give us useful feedback, and we spend a lot more time thinking about mistakes than successes.
Oh, isn't that the truth?
So true. Right. And we learn also by a series of successive approximations. We do what we can, the present state, and compare that to what we want, the desired state. Well, I want to be a PhD historian, so what can I do now? And then how can what I do now, how does that become what I want? Okay, that would be one example. When student loans implode.
Right.
That's when I'll go back. I even told my mom that. I said, when the student loan debt bubble bursts, I'll be going back to school. And then,
and you're not trying to get out of your loan. We know you have a loan. You're not trying to get out of it.
Oh, I am so sick of people going, I even had some guy in a comment section. He goes, you need to get off your fat butt and go shovel or do some manual labor. I'm like,
yes, is that?
Excuse me. I said, you know what? I actually shoveled horse manure for 6 months. That was my job for a while. Mm-hmm. It was actually, I really loved the job. Mm-hmm. It doesn't pay anything. It's minimum wage part-time. But I actually loved the job. It was just, you go to work, you do it, and you don't have to talk to anybody. Right. I had Walkman on, mask for dust. I was good to go. I loved it. And I even went above and beyond and cleaned up all kinds of parts of the barn, etc. But I've done that. People need to understand, you can't go door to door with a lawnmower. Okay, number one, you're competing with immigrants who work for basically nothing. Number two, if a white person in this country, this day and age, goes around door to door with a lawnmower, I'm sorry to say this, but this is reality America. The first thing they're going to think, and I'm not trying to be slangish in a rude way, but they're going to think this has to be a tweaker. Mm-hmm. That's just how we think. And they don't want you near them. that isn't an option, kids. So this guy in this thing, he's like, why don't you go door to door with a lawnmower?
Exactly.
I'm like, boy, you're clueless.
Well, people,
no,
take comments out of they take comments out of context.
Sure.
And then attribute some evil objective that you might have.
All
and
right.
It's just so totally ridiculous. It just is so irritating.
Oh, yeah.
People
yeah.
are so stupid.
Exactly. Exactly. And no, nobody, everyone, every one of us would love to pay off our mortgage, pay our loan debt, pay
of
our
course.
Et cetera. But yeah, I mean, the reality of the situation is there's no money. The whole student loan thing is it's a whole different animal because it can't be discharged in bankruptcy court. And that actually passed under George W. Bush Jr. Wonderful G-Dub.
Yes.
The one that made that, him and his Congress, they're the ones that made that non-existent. And there was a reason for that, because the loan industry, the private banksters, and the government too, that just made $51 billion in profit under Obama in student loan profit, they knew this was coming. They were already making the bubble.
Yes.
They made the money. So they set America up just like the housing bubble.
Sure.
And personally, I don't have any grudge against people that walked from their loans, that basically mailed back their keys and said, take this loan and shove it, or take this mortgage and shove it.
Sure.
I begrudge them a thing. And I also am very sympathetic to people who trashed their houses out of anger, because when one thinks about the loss, they paid some of these people $4,000 a month mortgage payment and lost it after 5 years of paying that exorbitant robbery usury fee every month. The government just took it away.
Exactly.
Yeah, people get angry and rip ceiling fans out, tear out copper wiring.
Wow.
I mean, the drug addicts move in, squat, tear the place apart, tinkering with everything. Sorry. I don't begrudge anyone that does that. And if people want to be law abiding and think that's evil that some people did that, all power to you. But I'm a different person and I think differently.
Sure.
I mean, it's the same thing with the student loan crisis. I think that just, and I was trying to explain this to this guy, just logically, when the student loan debt is over $1 trillion, it's not getting repaid ever.
Right.
What part of that don't you understand? It doesn't matter what you think people should do. This is beyond paying back. It is a bubble that was deliberately created by banksters.
Sure. In order to enslave the students for the rest of their lives.
Exactly. It's a different way of thinking about it. And of course, I did apply for the income-based repayment plan. And mm-hmm. Get this. This is beautiful. They said, you don't qualify for this plan because your disbursement date was too early. I'm like, oh, that's cute. So you don't qualify for forbearance. You don't qualify for deferment. You don't qualify for income-based repayment. And you can't pay the loan. You can't pay the payment we demand. What option is there? There isn't. The only option for a student in that catch-22, which is a lot of students, is default. And that's
right.
What they want you to do because they can garnish your wages for life.
Sure.
So, you know, whatever. I mean, this guy was just silly. You're not getting out of your loan no matter what, because what happens is they garnish.
Right.
And, you know, I have government loans, so they know everything about me. It's directly tied to the IRS now, by the way. So when you go into studentloans.gov, they'll actually ask you if you apply for a repayment plan. They'll ask you, would you like us to send to request the IRS information directly? And you go, yes or no. You're directly hooked in already, people. You're not getting out of anything. So, yeah, that's just silly. And to expect a graduate who, fortunately, this isn't my situation anymore, but I know dozens of people personally that are in this situation that work part-time and are probably pulling maybe $200 a week income and living at home, you're not going to get a $400 a month loan payment from them. I'm sorry, people, but when you're making $800 a month as your total income, they can't take half. You got $400 to live on every month? That what part of that don't we understand? I think the problem is, and this is especially boomers, they don't understand that it's a new America. It's a new third world America, and your children are living it, Gen X and all the generations under it. Right. The Gen Xers, the millennials, and then Generation Z, which I don't know what they call them. We're the ones who are living the third world now.
Right.
I'm right in between. I'm almost a millennial. So I know, you know, I have several millennial friends that are a little bit younger than me that work three jobs. That's just the way it is. And they can't get into nursing school. They can't do all the things they want to do because they're either not the right skin color or they're just too many people applying. And so, you know, I think people need to be a little more sympathetic, you know, that
absolutely
are looking at the student loan situation. Okay, so with learning now, it literally follows what's called the TOTE model, which stands for test, operate, test, and exit. So the comparison is the test. The operation is where you apply your resources. Test by comparing again and exit from the loop when your evidence procedure tells you your outcome has been achieved. So instead of dwelling on mistakes and going, gosh, I was so stupid, I lost all that money or whatever the case is, mm-hmm. you go, what did I learn from that? That was obviously a mistake. Sometimes mistakes are so bad, they'll leave us with nothing.
I've known people need to learn. That have done that.
Yeah, we okay. still need to yeah. learn from those. It's not the end of the world. You can always climb back up. You may not ever be in that situation that you were, but use it as a learning experience from which you can become a better person.
Right.
How has it humbled you and made you value things that you might not ever have valued if you hadn't fallen from grace, kind of a thing?
Right.
Very important. And I just remember seeing on YouTube a case where a man who was in, he was a stock guy, very, very wealthy, two kids, wife, didn't work. They had a mansion, pool, etc. He got into a hedge fund that he had started on his own. It totally tanked. They lost everything. And he was literally begging for a part-time pizza delivery job. One can literally look this up on the internet. Rich guy who had to go to pizza delivery. They lost everything.
Well, I knew a family that this happened to.
Right.
They had a very, very nice home. He made these investments. I think he lost $1 million.
Right.
They had to sell their home. They had to sell their furniture that they had for years and years and years.
Right.
He also had a warehouse full of toys, you know, a snowblower and different bikes and cars and trucks. Mm-hmm. Everything went. And at the end, they got a divorce.
Oh, wow. That's sad that it ended like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because that really is a case where those two people, or maybe one of the people in that relationship, felt that losing the material things was the worst thing that could possibly happen and more important than the relationship.
Oh, yes.
So yeah. Losing the yeah. material gods was more important to have those material gods than the wife or the husband.
Absolutely. He was all into the things that he possessed. He was retired, but he had had a really fabulous job, mm-hmm. and he just couldn't deal with it. He actually
right.
had to go on medication.
Wow.
He had to go into a facility for a month or so. I mean, he was just beside himself. He would jump
yeah.
out of a car to try to do himself in. I mean, it was
wow.
just more
That's
than
sad.
He could handle. Yeah.
Yeah. And unfortunately, and Americans are still like this, the majority, we view homelessness as the absolute worst, most horrible fate that could ever happen to any of us. We'd rather kill ourselves than be homeless. That needs to change. Homelessness is not this, oh my gosh, determine who you are for the rest of your life. Oh, you must be the ultimate loser. You're homeless. But yet we have this attitude. It isn't, that's not at all. One can become homeless for a while and come right back up out of it.
Sure.
And if people fall into homelessness in a situation like we have now, That should be a learning experience. That's when people come together and start thinking of ways perhaps to go into business for themselves. Fortunately, in first world countries, at least for now, we can still get food provided. One can literally walk into the local quote-unquote welfare office and get food stamps without any ID, nothing. You're still fed. You'll still have somewhere to go. There are temporary shelters, etc. We still have some resources, some net. Spring back up from it. Who cares what other people think? They could be homeless tomorrow too. And if somebody is really going to judge another person for the rest of their lives or judge them as a person for being homeless, then that person is literally less than human. That's a scumbag. That's a judgmental scumbag. We need to ignore them. I mean, anybody that's that insecure that needs to say, oh, they're homeless, what a loser. That's a horrible person. The real loser in that case is the person saying that.
Sure.
So that needs to go away. And I do think that's particularly American, because in Spain and whatnot, there's a skyrocketing homelessness and there's not this same disdainful attitude towards the homeless. People there realize bad stuff happens. These people aren't to be defined for life as though they're some crud ball,
right,
you know, that is, you know, homeless material. I mean, we even think of, oh, well, that's kind of homeless material over there in America. I don't know what that is. It's a very diseased mindset, and it needs to stop, because we're really kind of a monetary society. We let money and class decide value.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, a real good example of this, just seeing the fall, is this little gal, Amanda, is her name? Amanda Bynes, B-Y-N-E-S. This is literally a very wealthy young girl, actor, you know, brought in young. And of course, this is what Hollywood does. They churn them and burn them.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to be on the street. And it's because she's doing, from looking at her, I know for a fact she's doing either meth or heroin. Not just marijuana.
That's too bad.
But it's very sad. I mean, you see that somebody can fall just from any small thing, but that shouldn't define them for the rest of their lives. You know, we need to see that it takes but one bad thing to bring a person down from being on top of the world to the lowest of a low situation.
Sure.
Well, we can't let that define people.
And this is not something that we actually cause.
Right.
I think I've heard the saying that so many people are one paycheck away from being homeless.
Absolutely.
So it's we've all become very dependent on corporations, and this was something that was set up a long, long, long time ago.
Right.
So that the powers that be could control labor and credit.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what they are doing. They are
Absolutely.
Diminishing people. On purpose, it's deliberate, and it's very sad.
Exactly. Yep. And I mean, any one of us can just think of your ultimate idol person and imagine them just getting into the wrong drug, or maybe there has been. Sadly, I think Justin Bieber's headed to the has-been status. They're done using and abusing him and exploiting him. They fall. Why should we go, oh, what a loser? Well, you used to think he was on top of the world. You thought he was the most gorgeous thing that ever walked on the earth, and now he's a piece of garbage and you're moving on to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
We need to stop thinking that way.
Right.
Because it's not true. The only thing that changed was circumstance and perception. That person is no different than they've ever been.
Right.
We need to stop doing that. So, yeah, that's just something to think about. And of course, this quote from the book is pertinent to this: a still higher level of learning, the hidden curriculum, if you will, what really moves things. We know, for example, that 4 + 4 = 8, but why? Okay, getting behind to the executive level of thinking, it results in a profound change, we would hope, in the way we think about ourselves and the world. It involves understanding the relationships and paradoxes of the different ways we learn to learn. And of course, perception and everything goes with this. Let's see. Oh, here's a good example. How about the triple description? And this would go with our whole thing of seeing people fall from grace, etc.
Okay.
To be a homeless person. Firstly, you can look at the world completely from your own point of view, your own reality within yourself in a completely associated way, and not take anyone else's view into account. How does this affect me? That's the average American. Very selfish, in my opinion, most that I've encountered. Unless they've been humbled, I find people of the quote-unquote lower class, lower status, far more enlightened, far more willing to accept hearing any kind of alternative history or viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Just so much more open-minded than upper class and middle class.
Oh, absolutely.
Bourgeois drives me insane. Secondly, you can consider how it would look, feel, and sound from another person's point of view, which is called second position. This is empathy. And this is what psychopaths cannot do. And it is actually a brain problem. Their brains work differently. The empathy sector that normally triggers in a normal brain does not in a psychopathic brain for whatever reason.
Right.
Certainly there's a genetic component.
And they even hurt the
further trigger.
Excuse me. They even hurt the people that they love because they have no empathy for people like their spouses.
Exactly. And unfortunately, the upper class, especially in America, is very psychopathic. Psychopaths tend to rise to the top. And they've even found this in chimp studies, where psychopathic chimps will dominate all the normal chimps and basically brutalize them into submission, and they'll become the dominant chimp. So there's similar pathological behavior in higher primates that one can observe. And you'll even find psychopathic behavior and asocial behavior in crowding situations with mice, for example.
Oh, really?
Yeah. If you look up mouse crowding experiments, they've done this before, you'll start seeing homosexual behavior in the mice, psychopathic, sociopathic, mice that don't want to associate with anybody and go off on their own, and you'll even see murder.
Really?
Where mice just randomly start killing each other simply because they're overcrowded. And I thought, cities,
city life.
Interesting.
Sure.
Okay, and then thirdly, you can have the experience of seeing the world from an outside point of view if you are a completely independent observer. So you would ask, how would this look to someone who's not involved? And again, this is trying to expand our point of view of the world, trying to get outside of ourselves so that we can be more empathic, more understanding of other values, cultures, people, individuals, situations, etc. So this certainly applies to how we view celebrities, how we view homeless people, how we view the different classes, etc. We shouldn't be so judgmental.
Right.
And I guess, let's see, I'm trying to see if there's, maybe we should go through the phobia cure. Since I said we were going to get to that one last time and we didn't, and we're running out of time. Okay, so there's different orders of change in behavior in NLP. And so the phobia cure is one of these orders of change. And this would be first order change. So you can, again, as we already went over, you can only feel in the present moment. So any bad feeling from an unpleasant memory must come from the way you are remembering it, how you felt back then. So the technique to get over phobias from the point of view of the guide or therapist. So first of all, the client is going on a difficult journey into the past. So set up a powerful safety anchor. You can either establish a here and now anchor, or you can ask the client to think associated, so they're actually doing it, to a past experience where they felt very safe. Maybe sitting and talking with their mother or being hugged by somebody, anything where they're safe. Have them see the scene, hear the sounds, feel the secure feeling, so fully associated. Anchor this security kinesthetically by touch. So maybe when the person grasps the chair arm, that's going to be the touch that triggers that anchor and feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure your touch brings a feeling of security. Holding hands works well, where the therapist can hold the person's hand, or the person can just hold an inanimate object if they're not comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm.
You will literally be in touch with what the person's feeling. You can hold the anchor throughout or use it when required. Number two is ask the client to imagine himself in a cinema or watching television with a still frozen image on the screen. When that is established, ask the client to imagine floating out to watch himself or herself watching the screen. So one is literally seeing, for example, their younger self on the screen with the spider.
Mm-hmm.
They're sitting in the chair in the here and now and watching themselves as a child with the spider on the screen. But then they're also floated out and watching themselves sitting in the chair, sitting there watching the screen.
Mm-hmm.
So you're actually three times removed from the incident. The last part is have the client float back along their timeline to the unpleasant event or to the very first incident that set up the phobia. It may not always be possible to get the first, but get the earliest possible. Have the client run a film of this incident from just before the start when he was safe through to a point when the immediate danger was passed and he was safe again. That has taken one sentence to describe, but will take some time in reality. The client will be seeing this in a double dissociated state, watching himself, watching a younger self go through the experience on screen. This maintains the necessary emotional distance. From this position A in the diagram, and they have it.
Right.
Where
it.
You're sitting.
Cute.
Yeah, isn't it? Where the guy is standing there watching himself sitting in the chair.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the client watches his own physiology in position B as he watches the screen. So he's sitting and watching the screen. And then if his physiology starts to collapse into the phobic state, have him blank the screen immediately.
Hmm.
Ask him to start the movie again and ask him to change the submodalities of the picture on the screen. For example, making it darker, smaller, further away in order to reduce the intensity of the negative feelings.
Or make the spider really little.
Exactly. You could. Absolutely. Okay. So this is all part of coming to terms with the experience. It takes time and exquisite attention. And you may need to reassure the client by saying something like, you are safe here pretending to watch a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when the film is over, congratulate the client for having re-experienced this for the first time without collapsing into those old negative feelings. Have the client float back into his body. Now the client imagines stepping into the screen to give his younger self much needed support and encouragement. You can literally see yourself saying, I am from the future. You survived. It's okay.
Ah, yes.
Never have to go through it again. So you're actually consoling your younger self. The present day person with strength and resources, knowing what he knows, can cope with the incident.
Mm-hmm.
So if the original incident involved genuine danger, it is still all right to have some anxiety about it. And of course, it'll dissipate as one practices this more. So when the younger person you are consoling understands on that movie screen, ask the client to bring the younger self back from the screen into his own body and allow some quiet time to recover and integrate the profound changes that will have taken place.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can future pace. So you would imagine within associated state the next time that you expect to feel that fear. So maybe you'll think of that spider in the future, that spider encounter, and you're no longer going to have the fear. And I can only imagine that this technique would work for somebody who experienced something really awful like rape or something.
Mm-hmm.
One has to be able to dissociate and see it from that third position and be able to go back into the memory and console the victim state. I mean,
mm-hmm.
one may not have been a child at the time, so just the victim state in that case.
Sure.
And I guess that's probably about it.
I was talking with, excuse me, I was talking with somebody this week.
Uh-huh.
Excuse me. And he was doing this kind of, it was on the phone. And He said, now imagine that you're watching what you've gone through in the last 6 months. Mm-hmm. Imagine that you're seeing somebody else go through that. Do you feel empathy, or what do you feel for that person?
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to get me to take better care of myself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so you can use these picture references, or these screens, or these movie modalities, mm-hmm. to say, okay, pretend like this person, pretend that you're up there on that screen and you're somebody else. How would you feel about that person? And, oh, well, there's always somebody that's suffering more, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But I think it's really important that people appreciate their situation, especially if it isn't that bad.
Right.
Yeah.
But he said, when I said that, he said, no, you need to have a little bit of sympathy for yourself. Because mm-hmm. I always feel like, oh,
true.
You know, you just go on and you pick up and you just go on. You just don't stop. You
right.
just be strong.
Right.
Darn it, you be strong and you take it like a man or a woman, you know.
Right, exactly. And that's a problem. We that's kind of beating up on oneself.
Sure.
Right. Yep.
Or not allowing yourself to heal from something, or just ignoring something when it, you know, you may have a problem that is really needling at you inside that you're just not dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we do that. We let things go below the surface and bother us for a long time,
right.
without really looking at it and saying, okay, come on, let's fix this issue and let's deal with it in a healthy way.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Interesting. I guess, you know, that kind of relates to beliefs. Just one more thing I want to touch on.
Mm-hmm.
We believe what people say about us, and I think it becomes where we say it to ourselves.
Sure.
Like, I'm not allowed to feel weak or whatever, sad, or, you know, I have to pick up and move on. I can't cry, or I can't let my guard down. We believe what we not only tell ourselves, but what people say to us.
Sure.
And there was an IQ experiment done with this class, and they give the example in this NLP book. And the teacher was literally told that one group of students was low performing, kind of lower IQ.
Mm-hmm.
And the other group of students was high performing, high IQ, very smart, brilliant kids. The teacher's expectations alone made the kids who were all they were basically all the same performers across the board, made them perform bad and good accordingly.
Wow. Just from what the teacher thought of them.
Just from mm-hmm. what the teacher thought and how they spoke to the kids in the different groups. How mm-hmm. they treated them, and just the expectations. If we expect low, we'll get low.
Mm-hmm.
If a parent does not expect their kids to achieve, they won't.
Right.
If you tell your kid you're stupid, they are.
Mm-hmm.
This is a huge problem. The power of words, if you will. And there's a lot of good information in what's called like the meta model. Just the power of words and making sense of words in NLP. Let me see if I can just get a couple examples of that real quick before we run out of time. So just making sense of words here. Let's see.
We also do this when you were talking about mistakes earlier.
Right.
And depending on how we were treated as a child when we made a mistake, will mm-hmm. determine not only our ego or our self-perception, but we will also be very hard on ourselves later on when
right.
we make mistakes.
Exactly. So here's the one. They have different ones like nominalizations, comparisons, unspecified nouns, and unspecified verbs, but we're going straight to judgments. Okay, so judgments are closely allied to comparisons. And a lot of times one will hear like somebody who has depression, they'll say, I have no friends. No one likes me. I can't do anything right ever.
Mm.
That's so not true, because what I mean, just a simple challenge to somebody is you can say, wait a minute, that's not possible. Why don't you try remembering one time when you did have a friend or you did do something right? Can you remember? And they inevitably can and will.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you ask them, why don't you have that now? What prevents you from having a friend?
Mm-hmm.
Is it that you're always moping about the house, feeling sorry for yourself and remembering your negative thing, your negative memories?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you try going out and making friends? What stops you from doing that? You slowly break down their little wall, their little barrier.
Sure.
And literally asking someone what prevents you is very powerful. But basically, judgments need not involve comparisons, although they often do. But just being aware of this, if someone says, I'm a selfish person, you might ask, who says? And then if the answer is, I do, then you might ask, by what standard do you judge yourself to be a selfish person?
Right.
So there's just all kinds of really good things in here, examples. So in this instance, just the model is judgments are clarified by asking. And this is just so common with people with depression. They always say, I don't have any friends. I can't do anything right. Who is making this judgment and on what grounds are they making it?
Right.
People shouldn't be so hard on themselves, because who are they to judge that? Who are they to make that call about themselves? That's not possible.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, and I guess that's about all I've got.
Well, this has been just a very wonderful, wonderful visit.
Yes, it has. Trying to get away from the Third Reich for a little while. But I'm still reading lots of books. Oh, and by the way, a really good one is The Forgotten Access. There's volume 1 and 2 by a J. Lee Reddy. So if anyone wants to check that out, he gets into some really obscure, like Iranian poles that one doesn't often read about.
Oh, okay.
Great set of books.
I'm looking it up right now.
Okay, yeah, they have the 2 volumes on Amazon, so I got
that.
Oh,
goodness. I am such a bookworm. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah, I have so many books. They're like, I have to stack them now on the top of the bookshelf and on top of other books. And my mom's like, quit buying books.
It's just not possible.
I know. I tell her I can't stop buying books. So, yeah.
You just have to get more bookshelves. That's all. Or just...
Absolutely. I'm going to buy another shelf. I've slowed down a little bit, though. I'm trying to consolidate what I've got. And I'm planning on doing quite a bit of future research on this Eastern Front thing, the treatment of Ukrainians, etc.
Oh.
Definitely not black and white. We need to understand that.
That, like, Ukrainian situation. I mean, they starved.
German treatment.
Oh.
German of Ukrainians during that occupation. Not black and white. There are some legitimate arguments from the Ukrainian and the Polish side perspective, if you will, that the Germans were awful. There were some instances in the expulsion of the Poles from the Vartaland, etc., to the general government, it wasn't pretty. So Hasso was the one that brought that up, very true. But then again, there were many German officials that were very sympathetic, empathic, did all they could to help, etc. And what we need to understand is that if the NS system was so totalitarian and so racist and just committed to destroying these people, etc., like we're told, there wouldn't have been this independent initiative ability. There wouldn't have been this leeway to go either way.
Right.
So it's very important to understand that it was a huge spectrum of options that one could exhaust under that NS umbrella, that one could treat people really well or abuse them viciously. And both happened under the Germans, as it happens under anybody.
Exactly.
So I'm definitely going to be doing a lot more on that particular topic, because I think not too many people are aware of how German occupation really was. And there are some legitimate claims to horrors.
Mm-hmm.
Even from the Jewish perspective, the Jutsis even have some legitimate grievances against the German occupation in the East. So just going to get into that a little bit. And of course, the NLP has helped me expand my mind and broaden my view. Oh my gosh.
Well, it's history is very interesting. And as you say, it's very difficult for us to understand what happened 80 years ago, 90 years ago, because we just weren't there.
Exactly. So we weren't there. And all we can do is rely on what people tell us. And
right.
People are always being honest.
Sure.
And then, of course, there's the one that write the memoirs where I was always all loving. I saw the light. I. And you're like,
right.
No, you didn't. You just wrote your memoir like that to make yourself look good.
Right.
And that's always a challenge to kind of figure out, okay, how much of this is actually true?
Sure.
And if a historian can't determine what is actually true and not based on other memoirs or actual facts that contradict what a memoir says, we can at least say this is a potentially biased and not entirely honest account. So just keep that in mind.
Sure.
As long as we deal with the potential bias there.
And you have to read with a critical eye.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And everything.
Right.
And I just got two more wonderful reviews of my books, a 1-star on Albion and Zion, and a 1-star on the 2010 Black Nazis 2. And it's the same idiocy. I just like, you didn't read the book, number one. It's very obvious from the reviews. Very obvious. But number two is like, you know, you people don't need to lie and slam. A legitimate critique is more than welcome from me.
Sure.
I want a good, solid critique of my research and my methodology. I have not received that yet. And I think one of the reasons is when somebody does give you that genuine, good critique,
it makes your
writing better. Well, no, it makes one's writing better. And I think that a lot of these academics and whatnot don't want to give me that opportunity. Probably people like you as well. They don't want to give us that feedback that will make our writing and our arguments stronger, because it really challenges their nonsense.
Right.
For example, why didn't Ethan B. Katz write a good, solid critique of my book and actually read the book and say, hey, you falter a little bit here. Okay, you say, here's an example real quick. That one Vitch essay where he's talking about the slavery in Germany, the alleged slavery of the Eastern workers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of those people were like one could call it de facto slavery. They were brought directly from the concentration camps to Germany to work as POWs.
Right.
Technically, that is considered slavery. Okay, fine, I'll hand him that. But what somebody like Ethan B. Katz could have said is, okay, if you're saying that people illegally immigrated to Germany from the East, can you assure me that they didn't illegally immigrate to the Reich proper because the German occupation was so bad? And what would your evidence be to contradict that? So are you sure they weren't just Eastern peoples escaping the horrors of German occupation to the Reich, taking that as a better opportunity than being an Eastern worker in the East under, say, Erich Koch? And then I would go, well, we have this example to counteract that potentiality.
Sure.
I haven't gotten that kind of feedback that, you know, is really important to making the research more solid and the arguments more solid. And I have a feeling that they want to deny us that kind of critique.
Of course.
Right. So, and that is a potential problem I found with Vitch's essay and his argument, that he's saying, because I've read other books that say the Eastern occupation was very harsh, very brutal. The peasants weren't getting their private property back quickly enough. The Germans were staying with the communes that were already set up by the Soviets, and they weren't disbanding them because it was easier for the Germans to keep those going. Did that maybe drive some of this desire to go to the Reich proper and work there? But then you come across the information that Eastern workers were volunteering to clean up after air raids. They were receiving free clothing. They were paid well. They were getting vacation time.
Right.
There's things that definitely
legitimize
Vitch.
Yep.
Right. So that's just more stuff I'll be dealing with in future. And have you started on your third book yet?
Yes, I'm well into it.
Awesome.
It's supposed to be out in June. It's just not going to make it.
Right. It's always hard to make those deadlines.
And it's my own self-imposed deadline when you're doing your own publishing and everything. But you do.
Oh, yeah.
You make a deadline and then you try to abide by it. But then if you don't, oh, well.
Exactly. It's good to just have it there so that you're not procrastinating. That's
right.
What I found.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, looking forward to that for sure.
Yeah. The cover's already designed. And
nice.
Yeah. I like the cover real well.
Okay. Great. All right. That's all I got.
All righty. Well, thank you so much. And we'll be talking soon.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care.
You too.